came to America when he was 6 months old. He started as a stock boy at the grocery store. Eventually, he owned it. He turned it into the biggest grocery store chain in New York City. He now owns a real estate company worth over $2 billion. He ran for mayor of New York City. He almost won. You can't make this story up. This is the Katz Roundtable with John Catsimatidis.
Everywhere around the world, they come to America.
Good morning, New York. This is the Katz Roundtable. John Catsimatidis here, Sunday morning. One great show for you today. Nicole Galinas, what's going on with the migrants? Randy Mastro, congestion pricing representing New Jersey. Eric Schuffler, what's going on in New Jersey? Steve Cates, what's going on in the skies? And about the eclipse, Governor David Patterson, what's going to happen with the budget? Dick Morris and Steve Moore. And let's start off with Michael Stoller on what's going on in real estate in New York.
Good morning. This is Mike Stoller for the Stoller Real Estate Report on the Katz Roundtable. So what's happening in the availability of financing for real estate? During these interesting times, the rates, the T-bill rates are down 80 basis points over the past couple of months, but there are difficulties. Everybody hears about New York Community Bank, Flagstar Bank, and the question is, are there other banks in difficulties? And the other matter over there is, who's providing financing in these times? Are there new players? Where do you have the opportunity? So this morning, as I said, I have Ronnie Levine, who is the Senior Managing Director at Meridian Capital Group, and he is a leader, truly, in understanding what's going on. So is there money there?
Hey, Michael. Nice to see you. There's always money in the system. Really, the question right now is the cost of capital. And, you know, with the amount of loans that are in the system right now, that can't be refinanced. I think that's the biggest issue facing the market right now is not the availability of capital, but it's just the leverage points that can be achieved and the cost of that capital makes refinancing a lot of existing loans very challenging.
So how are these people going to refinance their projects?
That's an issue that we're contending with on a daily basis. A lot of these deals require significant infusions of cash. The refinance proceeds are coming in significantly less than the loan balances when they mature. So you're either going to have to raise preferred equity, or you're going to have to get some kind of subordinate debt, form of mezzanine capital. You're going to have to bring some more equity to the table, or you're going to have to cut a workout deal with the bank. I mean, those are really the only options.
So are banks already doing working out deals?
We've seen some workouts from some banks. We've also seen some banks quietly selling distress note positions. So there's a combination of things going on. It really depends on, you know, I think the simple rule with a workout with a bank is they're generally willing to play ball with a borrower that is willing to invest fresh capital into the asset. So if the borrower is willing to kind of invest back into the deal, you'll generally find more receptivity from the bank to work with them.
With regard to new players in town, are there any banks? I had read the other day that Axios and Huntington Bank have been pretty active as a new lender.
Yeah, I mean, there's always new entrants into the market. I think what we're seeing today with the banks is that, you know, to get them to extend credit in real estate, the majority of the banks are looking for a relationship. So what that means is they're requiring deposits. And so, you know, some banks are requiring, if you're going to borrow, you know, $10 million, they want sometimes up to $2 million in deposits. So 20% of the loan amount some banks are looking for. Look, there's definitely new players in the market, but not enough to replace the signatures in New York Community Banks that were the major providers of liquidity in the New York market. But what we have seen is also the CMBS market, which is really the securitized or Wall Street type lenders, stepping up and providing some liquidity in the rent-regulated space, which is nice to see. So we've done some rent-stabilized portfolios and buildings with what I'll call, you know, securitization or CMBS loans.
At what pricing?
You know, look, pricing is over the index. Generally, it's either 5 or 10-year loans, and, you know, spreads range from, you know, call it in the you know, 200s, low to mid 200s. It depends on the leverage point, but there's, you know, those are fixed rate loans. They get securitized, and they're, you know, they're generally being more aggressive on proceeds than the banks right now.
But what about condominium loans?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think we're going to see more condominium loans as the 421A went away and people really, the viability of building rentals on a lot of land in the city doesn't work. So we're seeing people pivot towards condo plans. You know, there's definitely liquidity for condos. It's just a question of, can you make the math work on a condo deal? The lenders are going to want to, you know, they're going to want to be, you know, no more than generally 60% of loan to net sellout. So, you know, you're going to have to look at what price points people are projecting. I think lenders generally want to stay away from the very large, super high-end expensive units. They want the kind of more, you know, in that, call it $2 to $5 million range, where it's a little bit more liquid and they move a little bit faster.
So when I was on TV, I used to have my Crystal Apple, and I would rub it and I would ask Crystal Apple, what's going to be? How do you look for the end of 2024 and 2025?
You know, look, that's a great question. I think there's a few cliches that are pretty prominent in the market right now, and it's higher for longer, right? Which is referring to kind of the, you know, the reality that rates are not coming down anytime soon. And, you know, this hope that the Fed is going to lower rates, you know, inflation keeps popping back up. And I think the market sentiment is that the amount of cuts and the severity of cuts to rates is not what people are hoping for. So everyone's monitoring that. And I think the other cliche that you keep hearing a lot is survive till 25. So, you know, I think hopefully towards the second part of this year, you'll start to see rates come down, you know, hopefully in that 50 to 75 basis point context. And that'll give some breathing room. I don't think that that's going to cure all the problems in the market, but it certainly take a little bit of pressure off.
I'd like to thank Ronnie Levine for being here, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you for listening to the Cats Roundtable. We'll be right back right after this break. Welcome back to the Cats Roundtable. With us today is Governor David Patterson. Governor Patterson, give us an update. Where the heck are we?
Well, they haven't passed the budget in Albany. They pushed the date now to April 8th, which will be Monday. That would be apropos since we had an earthquake earlier in the weekend that we end with a total eclipse of the sun and maybe even a total eclipse of the issues in the budget. But we'll have to see about that. Right now, it doesn't really matter if the budget is a week or too late. What matters is when it gets to about a month and then the parties become intractable. And you have situations like one I was in 2002, when the budget didn't pass until August 11th of that year. So believe me, next to that, we're doing okay.
You got it done, and you got it done the right way. We were hoping that Kathy Hochul, that Governor Hochul will hang tough and make sure we get the right deal for our city and our state, because, you know, people don't trust things.
Well, the governor tried to put some added protections in, particularly raising the penalties for assaults on store workers and that kind of thing. The budget, the legislature didn't go for it. And it's interesting, we had a guy on Thursday night named Rafael Mangual, and he is a, you know, kind of senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. And he's a real specialist in researching police and public safety issues. And he pointed to a study that showed that in the states that use three strikes and you're out, after three strikes, you're in prison for life, that when the criminals got to their second offense and they knew that there'd be three strikes, you're out, that the crime went down 23.8%, as he pointed out. Now, the bad news is that 76.2% of the people went right ahead and continued committing crimes. And that brings us to the fact that you pointed out on the show Thursday, there are only really about 3,500 continuing criminals. In other words, people who, even when you try all the rehabilitation, it never works. They just go back to doing what they're doing. And I think that what we really need to do is to now base the, what I think is we really need to do is each time someone commits a crime, based on what that individual did, the penalty gets higher. So in other words, their second offense, they may get 3 years. Their third offense, they may get 9 years. Their fourth offense, to try to find a way to get this very few number of people off the streets, the crime rate would go down significantly.
Yeah, but if they're repeat criminals, is there at some point that people decide they don't belong in the streets of New York? And are there some point that somebody has to make a decision, do they belong in a mental hospital or do they belong in the jail?
Yeah, well, I agree with you completely. What it is that since there are a number of people who seem to oppose these long sentences, that the sentences would be graduated so that eventually you would get them all out. There's a shorter way, you know, and it would really be just on the third offense to then make that the three strikes you're out, like they've done in other states. And what Governor Pataki tried to do in New York, but he wasn't able to get the legislators to follow him.
What else do you have to get off your chest on a Sunday morning?
Well, one thing I'll tell you, it's a little unrelated to everything else, but 61 years ago, I hate to say it was that long, I went to the Hayden Planetarium, and we were going to have a total eclipse in New York City in June of 1963. And on that Saturday, when we all were waiting for the eclipse, it never came. So they said, well, the next time it's going to come is 2024. So I've waited all these years, and I better see a total eclipse on Monday, or I'm really going to be in a bad mood.
Well, it's going to happen. They can, you know, certain things don't change, and it's going to be, I think, in New York between 1 and 2:30 or 3:30.
Well, you know, what can always kill it is the weather. If the weather changes, you wouldn't see it. It'll get darker, like an eclipse that occurred in 1979. But I want to see the real eclipse. I want to see the sun with that ring around it. And if I don't see it, it's really going to ruin my spring, John.
Well, Governor Patterson, thank you for coming on this Sunday morning. And maybe we'll go out on Monday and watch the eclipse together.
It'd be my honor.
The Cats Roundtable.
With us this morning is Nicole Galinas from the Manhattan Institute and City Journal and contributing editor to the New York Post. Nicole, tell us, what is going on?
Good morning, John. Well, what is going on? There's a lot going on. Among all those things is the city finally started giving out its debit cards to migrants at the very end of March. So for this pilot program for 115 families who are staying at the Roosevelt Hotel, the Row Hotel, the Watson, the Stewart, you know, all these Manhattan hotels that have been turned into migrant shelters, the city will give a family of four $350 a week, which works out to about $1,500 a month on these prepaid debit cards. And the families are supposed to only buy groceries and baby supplies with this. But there's a lot of problems and questions with this program. I mean, you can start with a no-bid contractor. You know, why did the city only consider this one vendor, Mokify, out of the hundreds of financial companies, benefits provision companies that New York has? And then there's the issue of, does a program to buy groceries even make sense when there's no stoves, there's no refrigerators in these hotel rooms? You know, they keep trying to compare it to food stamps, but you buy food stamps to cook your, you use your food stamps to buy groceries to cook your food at home. The migrants can't do that. They are dependent on prepared food. So in terms of what the city should have done, you know, maybe invite many different ethnic vendors to come and sell prepared food to the migrants, let them use vouchers to buy prepared food, just buy the baby supplies wholesale and let the migrants kind of shop for the wholesale price baby supplies within the hotels. I mean, there's a lot you could do here, but the Adams administration didn't really think this through very well, or maybe they did think it through, but their goals are different from the city's goals.
On the radio in the last few weeks, I've been making an example that the total cost of a migrant is like $380. Do you remember the number?
Yeah, they say they've gotten it down to closer to 300, but it is very high. I mean, we've got a $1 billion hotel contract. You know, the contract with the Hotel Association in New York City is $980 million, and it goes through next year. So just $1 billion on these hotel rooms alone.
Isn't it crazy? I mean, that number makes no sense at all to me. If a poor New Yorker gets $20 an hour, let's say, 8 hours, that's only $160 a day before taxes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the first question, of course, as we've been talking about for 2 years, is does the city even have a responsibility to house all of these migrants? I mean, no other city has this right to shelter. The modification that the city did with the Coalition for the Homeless, it doesn't really do very much. It just says after 30 days, you have to reapply for shelter again. But if you don't have shelter, you go into the shelter again. For the families, you have 60 days, and then you can reapply and go back into the shelter. But the second question is, we're providing these services in the most expensive way possible. I mean, for example, they could have had the hotels compete against each other on price and, you know, do a bid and say, we got, say, 100 hotels that would rather be migrant hotels. Let them submit bids on how much they'll charge the city. Instead, they let the hotels congregate under this association and just submit one bid. And so that ended up being much, much more expensive than it would have been otherwise. And the food provision, I mean, they claim that they have to do these debit cards because the contractor they have, another no-bid contract, they serve food that is either bad or moldy or the migrants don't eat. Well, serving food is not that difficult. I mean, we serve 1 million school children a day. There's food in public hospitals. There's food in the jail. This isn't that hard to give people a reasonable choice of foods, including ethnic choices, vegetarian choices. I mean, it may not be the best food in the world, but they can't even do this basic thing. And so they have a new solution to the problem instead of just solving the problem, you know, just serve people an array of hot meal choices every day. You don't have to start giving out debit cards.
The budget is up midnight tonight, Sunday night, and or Monday. I'm not sure. But my advice to Governor Hochul was to hang tough, because if we don't fix the city right now, I think we have a problem.
Right. I mean, we are at a hinge point in the city's history. You know, this is the biggest hinge point that we've seen since 9/11, when we weren't quite sure how we would recover from 9/11. Would people go back and work in office buildings? Would these financial firms move to New Jersey? But we got a handle on that situation very, very quickly. I mean, people were back at their desks at offices within months. I mean, they were pretty much back by Christmas. The election of Bloomberg made it very clear. We wanted to rebuild the city to be a place that would be safe for everybody across income levels and welcoming to all sorts of business investment. We made it clear that at least we wouldn't be making it any worse or any more difficult to live in the city. And this time, you know, we're going on 4 years since the COVID lockdowns, and it's still very, very uncertain what the recovery looks like. You know, we still continue to lose population in four boroughs, and the mayor, frankly, has not shown decisive leadership in cleaning up what Midtown looks like, really handling the subway violence, you know, square on. He's out there saying it's just a perception problem, when we just had this poor person, Jason Pultz, pushed in front of the subway by a stranger barely 2 weeks ago. So, you know, a lot of issues that we're not dealing with in the decisive way that we dealt with them after 9/11.
Anything else you want to tell all New Yorkers?
I mean, I guess we'll see what comes out of the state budget. You know, the governor had difficulty even getting the most basic changes to the criminal justice code out of the assembly speaker, as we've seen in the Post all week. But, you know, some of this stuff, too, they can do without changing the law. You know, they keep claiming they need all these law changes to enforce the laws against the illegal marijuana sellers. They can shut these things down under existing state and city law. There's nuisance laws. There's laws that you have to pay your employees Social Security contributions and workman's comp, and you have to give out paper receipts. There's all kinds of rules and laws that they are breaking. So they're just hiding behind, oh, we need more changes to the law. You know, you can hold them accountable now. And that's the same thing with Adams wanting a change to the mental illness laws, so make it easier to involuntarily commit people. You don't need a change to the law to start dealing with the serious mental ill issue much more assertively. They're not even using the full authority that they have to commit people right now. So when they say, oh, we can't do anything, our hands are tied, you know, that generally turns out not to be true. If you want to get something done, you'll get it done.
Nicole Galinas, thank you so much for coming on this Sunday morning, and thank you so much.
Tom.
Thank you for listening to the Cats Roundtable. We'll be right back right after this break. Welcome back to the Cats Roundtable.
New Jersey, each day your beauty shines from farmland to the shore.
With us today is Eric Schuffler, and he's a good friend, a partner in the Ferry Hawks, and one knowledgeable guy of what's going on in New Jersey. And Eric, good morning. First of all, I understand there's some new laws going on in New Jersey. Give us an update on the Senate race, the governor's race.
Thank you, John. Never a dull moment in New Jersey politics and never a dull moment in New Jersey government. Lot going on. Let's start with electric vehicles. It's getting more expensive to have an electric vehicle in New Jersey. Under a recent plan by the governor and the legislature to fund the state's roads, electric vehicles will now have a $250 registration fee. And I think a lot of the thinking makes sense. Cars pay a gas tax to help pay for roads, upkeep, and repairs. Electric vehicles use the roads. They need to do it also. They're on the roads using it. I think that's common sense. The governor has also proposed that the sales tax exemption for electric vehicles would be phased out as a way to help generate revenue. So I think you see New Jersey's been a leader on electric vehicles, a leader on global climate change, but the economic realities of electric vehicles also use the roads, and we need to get revenue from them to help upkeep our roads.
It seems logical, and whatever will be, will be. Give us an update on the Senate race.
Yeah, that is the big news, and it's just not Senate race news, John. It is kind of transformational news on the New Jersey political scene. And New Jersey has been the only state, really, where your position on the ballot line is determined by different counties and their leadership. They select where you appear. The people in the county governmental political system get together and decide that. It's been challenged in court, and a court has ruled that it is illegal for New Jersey to do that. So this changes the entire way New Jersey runs and supports candidates, where now all the candidates for Senate need to get put together, as opposed to saying, I'm running aligned with Joe Biden. So this is a humongous change on the New Jersey landscape. It hasn't been settled yet how it's being done, but it really started as challenges to Tammy Murphy's Senate race by Andy Kim, who was running against her. But the ramifications of this for New Jersey politics, very wide, very deep, will be felt for a long time, and it's still being figured out.
It was surprising to a lot of people that Tammy Murphy left the race. What happened? Was it embarrassing to her husband, who even had visions of running for president someday?
You know, I think losing is never what you want. You never want to be on that side of it. You know, Tammy Murphy is a really strong Senate candidate. She's very substantive, you know, very independent, very knowledgeable. I think at this one got caught in the wrong time in the wrong place. And she felt, and they felt, that with the governor's position, her profile, they would have a lot of the political leadership with them, and they did. But that's why we run elections. And the grassroots movement in New Jersey, there was almost an anti-establishment effort that the voters said, you know, Andy Kim, who is a congressman, they didn't want that necessarily chosen for them. They gravitated there. And I think Tammy made the right choice in saying this race is going to get tough. It's going to get ugly. The likelihood of victory wasn't as high as she thought. And for the good of the party to solidify, pulled herself out, but definitely a setback.
Menendez, what's going on with him?
He's still out there trying, John. He has indicated that he will not run in the Democratic primary, but he's indicated he's still considering running as an independent. So he's still facing charges, a variety of different legal charges, but he's keeping his name in the race, probably for strategic reasons. Maybe that helps him with negotiate a deal, helps him with leverage with political leadership, but he's still in the race for now, but just not as a Democrat.
So he's still threatening to run as a third-party candidate.
He is saying, you know, he is holding his option open to run as an independent. The only thing he said is he will not run as a Democrat. So that's...
Well, is that part of the negotiation to wipe out any charges?
It would seem that once you say you're not running, you lose a lot of leverage. As long as you're willing to stay in the race, it's a card you can play or give up.
Understood. Now, who is there a Republican person running for...
You know, I think the leading Republican candidate for the Senate race is Curtis Bayshaw, who is, you know, someone I've known a long time, very common sense, John, you know, strong on economic growth, comes out of South Jersey, a background as a hotel developer, done some work in New York City, a lot of work in Cape May, that's been his base. But, you know, he'll be a good candidate, but this is still the Democrats' race to lose with Andy Kim, Congressman Andy Kim, now with the Democratic nomination really his.
And governor's race not coming on until next year.
2025. That is what the big focus in New Jersey is. So the jockeying for that is underway. And, you know, what happens with this court decision about how county lines are awarded really has an impact on that. So that is going to be heating up very, very soon.
Let's go back to the Staten Island.
Our favorite topic.
Our favorite topic. And me and you have a lot of fun with the Ferry Hawks. Give us an update on the Ferry Hawks.
John, we are like 3.5 weeks from home opener on May 3rd. We have a great opening weekend planned. Home opener May 3rd. I know you'll be there. I'll be there. May 4th, that Saturday, our first fireworks. It's a special night we're doing. Faith and family to honor all of our spiritual institutions, followed by a night of fireworks. We got one of our little leagues out there, Snug Harbor Little League, who's our neighboring little league. But we got something really cool coming up on Monday, John. We're having a solar eclipse watch party at the stadium from 12 to noon. We're opening up the stadium to the public. Come on in, have a Nathan's hot dog, have an ice cream, have a pretzel. You know, we're expecting 500, 1,000 people to come to the stadium for a real community viewing of the solar eclipse.
Now, I hope they have the right glasses. Otherwise, I don't want anybody to hurt themselves.
Very serious having the right glasses. We're partnered up with several nonprofits on Staten Island who are going to be selling glasses, you know, at the stadium with the donations supporting nonprofits. You know, this is, you know, what you and I envision the team, a community asset, community responsibility, the stadium open serving the community.
I can't believe we had an earthquake the other day.
I was here with you as in the office going through some Ferry Hawk and other items, and you could feel it, a little shaken, but we're New York, we're tough, we're resilient, we move forward.
Eric Scheffler, thank you so much, and we'll catch up again real soon.
Thank you, John. God bless.
The Cats Roundtable.
What is today? We have a very prominent attorney. We have Randy Mastro. He served as deputy mayor in the Giuliani administration, and now he represents Governor Murphy of New Jersey on this congestion pricing. Randy Mastro, what the heck is going on?
Well, John, it's a pleasure to be with you again. What's going on is New York's MTA is, you know, trying to pay for its $15 billion capital program to a large extent at the expense of New Jersey, both financially and environmentally. It didn't do the environmental reviews properly. Federal law requires the federal FHWA never should have greenlit this project to go forward, fast-tracked it without a full environmental review, and the consequences are going to be felt not only throughout New York, but heavily, heavily in New Jersey, where so much traffic is going to be diverted from people trying to avoid this congestion pricing tax.
Yeah, they say to try to avoid it, they're going to try to go up and above it and up to the George Washington Bridge. So there's going to be more congestion and more pollution up in the northern part of Manhattan versus the southern part of Manhattan.
And John, imagine it in New Jersey. Imagine Bergen County, where even the analysis that was done by the Federal Highway Administration and the MTA shows that it's going to experience a huge spike in air pollution issues, in traffic. It's terrible what's going to happen in certain communities from this. And there hasn't been not a dime of mitigation provided for New Jersey and what's going to happen there.
Governor Hochul, today, when the MTA tried to make another money grab on the Verrazano Bridge during the marathon, Governor Hochul told him, "Forget about it." I mean, you got to put an easy pass on every runner.
Here's the thing, okay? The MTA, which already has the hugest budgets of any government authority, it has a voracious appetite for picking other people's pockets. You go after a not-for-profit like the New York City Marathon and the Roadrunners, and now they are trying to pay for their entire capital project, you know, with this congestion pricing scheme, unprecedented, first of its kind in this nation, yet they and the Federal Highway Administration say there will be no significant impact from that change. It doesn't compute, doesn't make sense, because it's not true. It's going to cause huge impacts.
When do we find out what the court is going to do?
Well, we had 2 days of hearings in Newark, New Jersey, in federal court. The judge committed that he's going to rule on this well in advance of the date the MTA says they're turning on the switch, which is mid-June. So we're hopeful to get a ruling relatively soon, and certainly well before that date. And we had 2 days of incredible hearings where we just laid out how many different ways this environmental review was deficient and how there's no mitigation measures, no mitigation funding for New Jersey, no financial benefit for New Jersey when its mass transit system is going to be taxed by this scheme. It's just not right. It's not fair. It's not legal under federal law. And that's why we're in court. And I give Governor Murphy tremendous credit for taking on the Federal Highway Administration and his friends in New York. But this is not how friends treat their neighbors.
Absolutely.
So good for him.
Thank you, Randy Mastro. And keep us up to speed.
John, pleasure to be with you. I'll keep
you
posted. Thanks.
Thank you so much. With us today is one of our leading economists in the country, Steve Moore. Steve, what the heck is going on? The market was down all last week, most of the week. Rumors on interest rates not going down. Other people say it's going down. Nobody really knows what's going on.
So good to be with you, John. Look, this was a week when we saw more signs of higher inflation, and that's known to people by just what they're paying at the gas pump. You know, the gas price has gone up at the pump by, you know, about 30, 40 cents in the last few weeks. In some places, they're facing $5 a gallon gasoline again. I like to look at the commodity prices, the prices of everything from oil to gas to corn and wheat and copper. And those prices, just since the beginning of the year, have gone up by about 12%. So I'm here to tell you, I think that we have not slayed the what I call the inflation dragon. I think it's still out there. People who have to do grocery shopping, people who have to fill up their tank know exactly what I'm talking about. But there's another element to this, John, and that's what's going on with the mortgage market.
And the mortgage market is creeping up because the doubt of interest rates going down and the fact that the Suez Canal and the Red Sea is still stuck.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So when Trump left office, people forgot that the mortgage interest rate was about 3%. It rose as high as 7%. But now I think in many markets, the average is about 6.5%. But that's still a pretty high rate compared to what it was. And so now these new reports are coming out, John. You may have seen these press releases that the average family in America can no longer afford to buy the median value house. And so people are being priced out of the market in a large part because the mortgage payments are up so much. And so, for example, the average mortgage payment on a home for a new sale, it used to be you'd paying about $1,800 a month. Now it's $3,000 to $3,500 a month. And that means the dream of home ownership for many Americans is become out of reach.
Are they going down because of higher interest rates?
So you're going to see, I think that it's starting to go down a little bit, John, but if these rates continue to be high and if they continue to rise, then I think you're going to see a correction in the market. And that correction is exactly what you're describing, that home values will have to fall because people can't afford the homes and the interest rates are higher. So the payments are more. So, yeah, I think we've hit, a turning point in housing prices. I mean, let's remember that they went through a big, big boom over the last 4 or 5 years.
The Red Sea and the Suez Canal, the Iranians, the price of oil, crude oil, is up to $86 WTI,
yep,
and maybe over 90 on Brent. So people are going to be seeing $4 oil soon, which is not going to make the voters very happy. The price of food not going down because of the price of oil. The only thing that was going up was the stock market, and it seems to be a little bit on the retreat now. I mean, what's the prognosis for November? I mean, if President Biden wants to win, he has to do something.
Yeah, you can't run for reelection if the economy isn't strong. And right now it's not strong. In fact, I'd argue, we had about a year of improvement. But now it looks like things are turning a little bit the other way. Remember, inflation ran up to 9% in 2022, the highest rate in 30 years. And then it came down to about 3.5%. But what I'm here to tell you is now it's rising to four and a half, 5% inflation. And that's a long way from the 2% inflation target that the Fed has set. Now, what does that mean for in terms of the Fed policy? I do not see a case right now for the Fed lowering interest rates and pumping more money into the economy because they have not defeated inflation. I know all your friends, John, on Wall Street would love to see lower rates, but when you've got prices rising by nearly 5%, it's going to be hard for the Fed to cut those rates and then say, oh, we're not being political, we're not trying to help Biden, because that would be the only argument for cutting rates right now.
And the Houthi leaders, the Houthis, are advertising that they've attacked over 90 boats so far. I mean, what the hell is going on?
Wait, say that again, that they're complaining about what?
The Houthi leaders, the Houthis in the Red Sea.
Yeah.
They are advertising, we have already attacked 90 boats. That's why the price of oil is up. That's why the price of food is up. That's why the stock market is down.
And it, you know what it shows, John, that United States, we appear on the little international scene as weak. And I hate to say that about this great country of ours, but I don't think if you had Donald Trump in the White House, he would have tolerated this kind of thing. We would have taken those people out within the first couple of weeks. This, John, how long has this been going on now? For a couple of months?
Yes. And we got problems.
You can't have pirates on the high sea. This is 2024. It's not 1884.
Steve Moore, thank you for coming on, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for listening to the Cats Roundtable. We'll be right back right after this break. Welcome back to the Cats Roundtable. With us today is Steve Cates, otherwise known as Dr. Sky. Well, how far can the eyes see? Can we see Mars? Steve Cates, tell us all the new stuff going on.
Well, good morning, John, and good morning to everybody listening to the Cats Roundtable around the nation. One day away, John, from the big total eclipse and partial eclipse that you and I have been talking about for quite a long time. But, John, just to talk about home-based New York City, how about this? On Monday, with hopeful, decent, clear skies, you get to see in New York City a 91% eclipse of the sun. It starts off at 2:10 p.m. local time. The maximum of this eclipse is 3:25 p.m. when the sun is 43 degrees high in the New York City and New York area sky, and it's all over at 4:36. But we're in Texas right now, actually driving, John. I can't believe it. This is like a 1,000-mile road trip. We'll be in a town called Junction, Texas. I'll be the speaker at the TexClips Music Festival. And we're in this path, John, that's only about 110 miles wide where the totality of this eclipse exists. So everywhere, people, of course, listening to the Cats Roundtable here, it's going to be an exciting event. Let's hope the weather forecasts are good for everybody to watch this, but safely. That's amazing.
Now, we got to warn everybody. There's a lot of glasses going around that may not be good glasses. So this is a warning. Be careful. Make sure they're real glasses that you could actually look at the eclipse. Otherwise, we don't want anybody out there to get blind.
Absolutely, John. And I'm not an eye surgeon, but I can just pass this on. Nobody normally stares at the sun for any reason, of course. But when people look at the sun without the solar glasses, they could damage that area in the back of the retina called the fovea, which is the area where you see centralized when you read. You know, people have had experiences. I'm not trying to, alarm people. But the safe solar glasses, they do exist out there. But here's a quick tip, and this is kind of comical to some. If you just took a regular saltine cracker, and I usually ask people in our programs, how many holes does that thing have? A real one has 13 holes. So hold a saltine cracker in your left hand. In your right hand, take a sheet of white paper, like copy paper, and with your back to the sun during the partial phase, you're going to see 13 little eclipses right on that sheet of paper. That's fun for kids. That's fun for adults. It's a safe way, just in case you're not able to get those safe solar glasses. But, John, at totality, if you're in that path, that's the only time you can look at the sun. And where we are in Texas, and soon to be at the location we'll be talking about, we'll get about 3 minutes of totality, and it moves itself all the way up. Let's talk about areas like Columbus, Ohio, and Cleveland, Ohio. There's a big baseball game, the season opener for the Cleveland Guardians on Monday. they're going to open up the parking lot to 30, 40,000 fans to watch the eclipse. And all places in New York State, John, actually the governor has given amazing, you know, attention to this eclipse. There's many eclipse parties and parks. So the New York State area, among regions around the country with clear weather, from Buffalo, New York, all the way over to Plattsburgh, is going to get a very rare event.
Let's go to other places. Let's go to the moon. Let's go to Mars. I always like hearing about things going on.
Well, John, here's some news about Mars, and most people probably figured this out, but this is newsworthy. We're talking about Mars becoming an eventual wasteland of spacecraft. Now, of course, we don't want to contaminate the planet Mars, because some people believe that we actually found material, meaning life signs, when the Viking landers went to Mars back in 1976. But somebody said that there was some contamination in the instrumentation. Thus, we don't know for sure if we ever found real life. But the problem is, we're seeing more and more space debris lying on the surface of Mars. And for people that want to keep the planet non-contaminated, that might be a concern. Even though it might not seem like a big deal now, we certainly don't want to make it a junk pile. And I don't think any rational person would want to have that happen.
What else would you like to tell us, Mr. Dunning? By the way, this morning or a couple of mornings ago, NASA made an announcement that they were told by our government to have its own clock on the moon. What do you know about that?
Well, John, it's important for many reasons here, because let me put it this way. Not only the time locations on the surface of the moon. See, nobody owns the moon. Nobody can claim, you know, real estate property and say they own it. Other nations have tried to do it. But in this particular case, what they're looking to do, they're looking to make sure that their lunar clock, because everything out in space, there's nothing perfect. Obviously, that's why we added daylight saving time. That's why we had leap year. So what they're trying to do is come up with, for the future, when astronauts do go to the surface of the moon, some sort of a coordinated, accurate time signal. Now, that's a lot of work to do, because we have to get to the surface of the moon and figure out how that's really going to work. So that's a really amazing story for the future. But gotcha. One thing, John, that I wanted to mention really quickly, we always talk a mystery of the week. And since this is eclipse fever, I thought of one that's so incredible. What is the mystery behind a thing called shadow bands seen at total eclipses? Now, this is interesting. People have reported, and this is pretty much commonplace, at the time of totality, when people are staring up at that eclipse sun, don't forget, on the ground, many people have recorded, like taking a white sheet, you know, pull it tight, these waves of light and shadows that go across the ground. What could cause it? For many, many years, scientists were confounded. But now we know, John, at the time of totality, the temperature drops maybe 10 or 15 degrees, causing this amazing disturbance in the atmosphere. And that, seeing a total eclipse and these shadow bands, it's really like a spiritual and otherworldly experience. Wouldn't you think? That's incredible.
Let me tell you something. There's so many things going on out there. So many nations sending spacecraft out there. At what point do we have a junkyard?
That's true, John, and we have to look at it above us. Remember, low Earth orbit, where Musk is putting up all those, you know, Starlink satellites. By the way, in Phoenix, we got to see a launch. People were confused. What the heck is that big thing going across the sky? But eventually, in short order, we're going to have to figure out how to police that area, clean up the contamination, because what goes up still must come down, and certainly inhabitants of Earth don't want to get hit in the head, not to be at least, you know, comical here. That's a very serious thing that we need to do. Well, one more thing, John, about this eclipse. I want to mention to people not only to go to WABCradio.com, where I'm privileged and honored to have the Dr. Sky Experience, great eclipse information, but also if you'd like to quickly just go to our own site, DrSkyEclipse.com, a compendium of information for people wherever the Cats Roundtable is heard. And obviously, John, we'll be reporting back as we talk with you and other great hosts here on this particular radio station, talking about the experience that we hope with clear skies and everybody, the great American total eclipse and partial eclipse of April 8th, 2024.
Thank you, Dr. Sky, and we'll catch up again real soon. God bless.
Thank you, John.
With us this morning is Dick Morris, a strategist for Bill Clinton, President Bill Clinton, a strategist for President Donald Trump. Has his ears to the ground. Dick Morris, give us an update.
Well, the big thing over the last few days is that Trump has expanded his lead dramatically over Biden. There's a new Rasmussen poll out today that shows Trump 8 points ahead of Biden. And the consensus of the other polling, earlier polling, had him 4 and then 6 points ahead. but 8 points is a new record. It shows his Trump is widening his lead among Latinos. He's gone from being behind them, of course, in 2020 to being slightly ahead, six ahead among about 2 months ago. And now it shows him 13 points ahead among Hispanics. It also, for the first time, shows that Asian Americans are switching to Trump. They voted for Trump by about 3-1 in 2020. This poll shows Trump narrowly leading among Asian Americans by 39-36. Trump had got 12% of the black vote in 2020, and the recent polls have had him rising to as much as 25 or 30% of the black vote. The Rasmussen poll, which might be overly optimistic, shows him getting 40% of the black vote. Biden still leads among blacks, but Trump is within 10 points of him on black voters. So when you combine the findings of the poll, which are a big lead and growing lead among Hispanics, a major presence among black voters reaching perhaps to 40% of the vote, and a lead among Asian voters, there just is a massive shift underway to Trump. It grows larger literally each day, and it's hard to keep track of it, but the latest Rasmussen numbers offer a perspective that is really surprising.
The other night, I was with the new RNC chairman, and he feels that it's going to be a landslide for Trump. And I was with Rob Gleason, who was 11 years the GOP chair of Pennsylvania, and he thinks Pennsylvania is going to make a big turn. Have you heard anything about those two?
New York, I think, and the national data, I think, is true. Pennsylvania, I've always seen as being the worst of the swing states, that we're only 1 or 2 points ahead in Pennsylvania. But all the numbers are shifting nationally. And you're dealing with a major, major shift that continues each day and each week, a cascading effect of voters leaving Biden and going with Trump. And it's self-reinforcing. The more people see Biden weak and losing, the more likely they are to switch to Trump. I really question whether they can possibly go with Biden as their candidate. The plug on his candidacy is literally being pulled as we speak.
Dick Morris, well, you're going to be on today on Sunday between 12 and 2. What are you going to be talking about?
Yeah, one of the things I'm going to be talking about is the new World Health Organization treaty that the U.S. is signing. And it basically turns our sovereignty over to the World Health Organization in the event of a global pandemic. And the WHO, World Health Organization, is the body that gets to decide when that takes place, when there is a global panic, when there is a pandemic.
Dick Morris, I'll be listening to you between 12 and 2 on Sunday on WABCRadio.com. And thank you so much.
Good. Thank you.
If you ever miss a segment or want to hear it again, go to WABCRadio.com, go to podcasts, go to minicasts, and play back your favorite segment. Thank you for being with us for the Cats Roundtable Local Edition, the number one show on Sunday mornings in New York. Keep listening to us for the Cats Roundtable National Edition between 9 o'clock and 10 o'clock. So we'll be back to you in a few minutes after the news.